just trying to change the world here, people.
Oh, really?
The Facebooking and the tweeting and the Instagramming, all that would not exist without our understanding of science.
So it's amazing that you do that as an insult.
You mean true for you is different from true for anybody else?
Yeah,
to
absolutely,
you,
because I can't
think either got to be true or not.
I can't, no.
Good evening, O'Reilly Radio listeners and citizens of Netlandia. Welcome to O'Reilly Radio Show 110. This is the we have special guests in-house, the creators of The First Adventures on Earth with Adam and Steve. If you're new to the show, which many of you are, because we got a whole lot more people out there that are actually watching than typical, thank you for bringing them. You're bringing the noise for us. On O'Reilly Radio, we dismantle the current events for your edutainment through mostly rational conversations that'll make you go, oh, really? I'm your host, Andy Cowan. I have my usual suspects. I've got Michael Robinson right down beneath me here. I've got Fred Sims. He's over there.
Good evening.
And I've got Daniel Atherton.
Wrong way. Hey. Other way. Nope. Keep going. There you go. You still went the wrong way.
I did.
I'm that way.
That away. He went that away. There we go. But we have our special guests. And they're way down there. There we go. Okay, please introduce yourselves.
My name is Todd A. Davis. I'm the writer and head writer and publisher for Highburn Studios, and I'm one half of the creative team of The First Adventures on Earth with Adam and Steve.
And I'm the other half. I'm Caitlin Gettler. I'm the artist for the strip.
Excellent, excellent. So, as we, as you can see in the live stream, hopefully you are watching the live stream. If you're not watching the live stream and you're catching us on demand later on in the podcast, then we highly recommend that you go out to YouTube, youtube.com/O'Reilly Radio, O'Reilly Radio, and that'll get you the video for the show. Of course, you can also do the Twitch replay. But in the video, we have at least the first panel, I believe, of kind of how Adam became a skeleton.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
It's kind of if we're going back for this particular strip that's up here is kind of the culmination of a longer story. Basically, my wife and I moved to Florida about 3 years ago for her work. I was working law enforcement at the time, and I got a job at Eastern Florida State College, working security for them. And so just walking around one day, ran into Caitlin and struck up a conversation. And we found that we both had an affinity for Doctor Who, as well as some other nerdy things. And she mentioned that she was an artist. I said I was a writer. And she showed me one of her little signature go-to characters, which was...
It was Steve. I used to draw a dinosaur all the time.
Okay.
I had an art project a while ago that I had to make a little flip book, and he was the first thing I drew. So
it's a great dinosaur.
Project. Yeah.
It's a great dinosaur.
So okay, here we go. She showed me the dinosaur, and I said, wow, it's a really great little character. It's fun. It's cute. The only thing I can draw is this little skeleton, and I would just doodle this little skeleton. He always wore a top hat, had a monocle, big cigarette.
Oh, how very fancy and posh. Oh, yeah.
Showed that to her. She was like, oh, that's cute. We should make them do something together. And I said, stay right there. I'll be right back. And I went, took a couple scrap pieces of paper, and about an hour later, came back with the first script. And it's exactly what's up there in the panel. It's Adam.
Okay.
I figured, okay, if he's a dinosaur, that means this took place a long, long time ago. And so we've got a skeleton. So maybe if this is some sort of man, maybe he's the first man. And my father was a Baptist minister. So I have a lot of...
I wondered where the Baptist reference came in.
I have a lot of Bible jokes up here that I never got to vent properly.
Comic therapy.
Exactly. It is very much comic therapy. So I said, you know what? Let's make him Adam. And in trying to find... a name for the dinosaur. Folks who have paid attention to anything from the Westboro Baptist Church. Adam and Steve. It's Adam and Eve. My brother came out a few years ago. His oldest daughter came out. And so coming from a super religious background, but then having, you know, family who didn't hold to that, and me kind of being on the outside looking in, I was able to see a lot of different things going on. And so, First Adventures on Earth with Adam and Steve. The joke in itself is...
Yeah.
I mean, the title itself is a joke. And but we just made it kind of like Calvin and Hobbes after
it's
that.
It's perfectly provocative.
Yeah, thank you.
It's very good. So, Caitlin, now, obviously, this is a bit irreverent.
Okay. Yes, a little bit. Yeah, it is. I mean, I grew up Catholic, so a lot of the times he had the jokes, and, you know, I'm really open-minded.
Okay.
And I thought they were funny. So I never had a problem with it. You know, okay. Sometimes I had to talk to my family and be like, hey, so this is what we're doing in the next one. You know, don't be shocked. But my family and my friends have been very supportive, and it's been great.
Okay, excellent. Yeah. So I'm going to guess that you're an atheist.
No. Still, I still consider myself a God-fearing Christian. I just don't force it on people.
Okay.
I tend to...
this is just not usually the humor that comes from a believer.
I just... I believe what I believe, and the things I went through in my life led me to believe that there's more to it than that.
Okay.
Was raised very heavily fundamentalist, Baptist, Wednesday night, Sunday morning, Sunday evening, without fail.
That hurts.
That was my life for about, let's see, till I was in high school. About,
I know those feels.
Oh yeah, it's fun feels. Yeah, absolutely.
I resemble that remark.
Yeah,
church camp. Did you do church camp?
I sure as hell did.
Oh yeah, me too.
I hated every second of it.
Oh yeah, it was
and the
awful.
Private schools and everything. You know.
Oh yeah, the private
the
schools.
The only thing I didn't have was the private schools because we were military and you couldn't.
Well, see, I came from a military family too, but they still sent me to a private middle school. It was like 3 years of.
I wasn't part of a military family, but my father was a Marine in Vietnam, so I got all the best parts of that.
Oh, I bet you did.
Yeah, that was great.
I'm waiting for the rest of the strips on that one.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to work that into my stand-up routine.
That's a totally different comic. Nice. That's not, it's not lighthearted like this one is.
No, it's not.
Well, no, you've got this, obviously... Homo sapien ancestor, you can include a little Neanderthal to be the Marine.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. Well, you know, and talking about it being provocative, and because we do have religious families, you know, necessity being the mother of invention, you'll notice the flower that's in front of
crotchy.
Crotch.
Crotchy, yeah.
Crotchy, the censorship flower.
That's so awesome.
And, yeah.
It's one of my favorites.
He makes appearances throughout, and she came up with it initially, and after that, he just kind of became the silent partner. It was just kind of like, whenever we needed him, he was always there. It's like, if you got junk, he's got you covered.
Nice. So,
bum.
Yeah.
It's your version of Thing.
Yeah, yes. Basically, yeah. Yeah,
fantastic.
Well, in the book, we did a little spoof of Guardians of the Galaxy.
I saw that, yeah.
And we drew Adam as Star-Lord. We drew Steve as Drax. Mm-hmm. And then we had Crotchy as Baby Groot, and it worked perfectly. So,
very nice art.
Yeah.
So speaking of that, so what is okay? What are your roles in building the comic?
Writer, artist.
Oh, it's a little more complicated than that, I think.
Of course it is. That's why I'm asking.
Well, I mean,
it's always more complicated than that. But on the surface, you know.
Yeah, once I type up the script and hand it to her, I think then it kind of becomes a little bit more of a collaborative, because sometimes I'll make a reference in the script that, I mean.
And she'll go, I've never seen Seven, so I don't understand what you're doing.
No, a lot of it was that he would make references to, like, hey, look at this movie for this panel. I'm like, I don't know that scene, okay. So he'd have to send me pictures or find it on YouTube for me.
Yeah,
we're going to go over this one more time. Catholic upbringing. Help me out here.
Well, the thing is, and also besides our different backgrounds, she's also 10 years younger than me. So, and I didn't really think that would come into play necessarily, but it ended up, you know, being a fairly big element.
A wee.
The RoboCop reference does not work.
Oh, no, I know RoboCop.
Which one?
Oh!
The very first one.
Okay, good. Okay.
It's the only one I've seen.
You know, the good one.
Oh, okay, good. The good one. Yeah.
I'm caught up on some things.
Claymation Cop. Loved that one.
Yeah, somewhat. Yeah.
But, you know, what would you say our relationship is once I'm done with the script? Because, sometimes I'll come to you with an idea.
Yeah.
And be like, hey, I'm thinking about this particular thing. And we may talk about it a little bit and just see if there is some, is that something? Can we take that somewhere? And
I help him flesh out some ideas sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes.
You put meat on Adam?
Yeah, basically.
Technically,
yeah,
I guess.
Basically.
But
puts the meat on the bones. You know, and then I would go and write the script and try to flesh out, you know, a single joke, you know, one single ha-ha moment, bring it back to her. And initially, my scripts were about page and a half, 2 pages. At the start, because
super detailed. Because I was very new to everything and never done anything like this before.
Yeah, this was our first time doing sequential
internship.
Ooh,
sort of,
pretty much. But it kind of let me kind of, other than the role of writer, it also let me take the role of teacher and kind of mentor. And like, this is the medium. This is how it works. And would show her other strips. Like we looked at Peanuts. We looked at Calvin and Hobbes, and just saying, you know, pay attention to the angles, pay attention to what they're doing, how the camera moves, for this, basically to help her get used to this particular medium. And then after a few months of doing the strip, my scripts got a lot shorter because I didn't necessarily have to explain so much.
Right.
And, you know, we both knew the characters very, very well, and we could see, okay, Adam's going to say something funny here, and Steve's going to be in the back, you know, with a confused look or something like that. And that's pretty much how it went for the most part. I mean, there was a couple of things in the book that we took from the news. There's one where we make fun of Brian Williams.
I saw that, yes.
Yeah. When that news story broke, I called her immediately and said, hey, have you started on the next strip? She said, no, not yet. I said, good, don't. I'll have a new script for you by the time I see you later today. And I sat down and wrote one real quick. That was a pretty quick one because there's not a lot going on there.
It relies heavily on awareness of the news.
And we wrote it. We put it up. I think I actually took more time describing the title panel for that strip than the actual strip itself. She wasn't familiar with Brian Williams.
I had to explain everything. I don't keep up with the news so much as I probably should.
But see,
well, even with that story, you'd have to have a long memory.
Yeah.
Anyway, which apparently he doesn't have either.
Exactly.
And there's the joke.
So. I mean, but it's kind of nice because we really balance each other out. Like, whereas I've got a lot of comic book knowledge and older movies, older TV shows. She comes with the newer stuff and video games. She plays way more video games than I do, so she can make video game references all day long, and I'm left in the dust. So it ends up being a pretty good partnership just because we do play off each other so well. So
yeah, he's good with the words. He does most of the talking.
You'll notice my voice is a little bit rough. I had strep a few weeks ago, so I'm still trying to kick the last one. Yeah, I know. it's mostly gone, but what's left is the smooth sounds of Barry White.
There you go. So, I've been sick on the show before too, and man, it definitely brings out that baritone.
Oh yeah. The wife's a big fan of it.
Oh, I bet. Yeah.
I just turned into Batman.
Hey, there you go.
So raspy, so angry, so raspy, so emo.
Harvey Dent. Can we trust him?
That's good.
Thank you.
That's really good. Okay. So they call him Tim?
Yes.
The time traveler?
Tim the time traveler.
We were very creative with the name.
Yeah. You know, because we...
I was wondering where that came from, and it's like, oh, that's got to be Monty Python.
Oh, no, it's, you know, in fact, I'm not the biggest Monty Python fan, but we both...
Get out.
I know.
Not a big Monty Python fan. I've tried.
Shame on you.
It missed me. But we had actually
we can throw a few more at you. You know,
oh, no,
you know, it'd be fine.
Well, no, at this point, we're just going to rename him the Spanish Inquisition because nobody expected that.
That's true. No one did expect that. It's nice.
We had thought about introducing a character. Introducing a character much like the Doctor, since we were both Doctor Who fans. Mm-hmm. And we even considered a time machine. We had thought like...
vortex portals and everything.
A portal, yeah. Or like space would just open up like a door and he would walk through it.
Sure.
But we ended up...
Going more Star Trek, I think, with the... He just phases in.
Yeah, he kind of phases in, much like Star Trek. And we had thought... I came to her with... I had an idea for him to look like he was out of the 1950s. Mm-hmm. You know, the big spacesuit, the big fishbowl.
A little Buck Rogers going on. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. And showed her a couple things online. Google Images is great for making references to things.
My best friend.
And we came up with Tim the Time Traveler, who just kind of, he has insight about the future, but knows that he can't say anything. So he's just back there to experience and sort of be an extra person for them to play off of and
accidentally kill butterflies, things like that.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Nice. We played with the idea of the butterfly effect. And, I actually, that's the nice thing.
I like
the
bing.
Oh, yeah.
The immediate mohawk was very nice.
Yeah, the hair
just immediately changed to a mohawk. It's like, oh, what kind of future was that?
Exactly.
That's what that was like. Whoa. Well, cyberpunk just happened all of a sudden.
Yeah. That's the nice thing about working at a college was I ran into one of our teachers who's an astrophysicist. And so I was able to ask him about faster than light travel and black holes and, particle colliders and all kinds of stuff. And, it really,
it is
the way he described, just the way that he described physics, just the way that, he described physics almost sounded like poetry. And, there he is.
I was really glad we didn't draw him again after that because I did not want his hair to go away.
Yeah.
Hair was my favorite part.
I adore the ghost butterfly.
Especially how happy he is.
Just laughing.
Yeah.
That is just
awesome. Well, especially
awesome.
When he sees that the guy's hair changed because he died.
Yeah, I think that's my favorite right there. The super happy butterfly. That's amazing.
That reminds me, the one thing we didn't do was... there was actually a post.
Yes.
Actually, that was a question. Hang on before you go further. A question from the chat room was favorite strip to draw and what was the worst, and also any ideas that never made the cut.
Yes. So there's something for. I'll let you start. Go ahead.
All right. Well, my favorite strip to draw was actually puzzles. It was just a strip where it starts out with the title panel.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a newspaper clipping.
Yeah.
With Yahweh walking around like he's Bigfoot and like polls about how the world's going to end and things
that. I just had to mention.
Yeah.
So it's Yahweh.
Yeah, it's Yahweh. Yahweh.
That's fantastic.
No,
Yahweh.
Yes.
Because it's the question of, wait a minute, you control everything? Yeah.
Yeah.
No way. Way. Okay, Yahweh.
Brilliant.
Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely brilliant. Okay. So, yes, he's doing like the crossword.
Yeah, where he's doing the crossword and Steve's helping him out with it. Mm-hmm. I just, out of all of them, that's my favorite. I love to look at it and the colors are pretty and I loved the way that he wrote the script. It was very, you know, it was adorable and it was just the two of them, just like, you know, it should be. So.
Yeah, I think that's one of my favorites too. That was a really fun one for me to write just because Steve only says one word.
Rawr.
So in trying to get him to say other things, but only having one word to play with, I had to figure out how to eliminate letters and get him to say other words. And when it gets down to beam of sunlight and he says ray, or he says ra, sun god.
Right. Yeah.
But he says ra and he looks at him and says it's pronounced ray, but he spelled it wrong in his dialogue bubble.
Right.
And then of course calls him a silly lizard. It's just a real nice interaction.
Wanders off all dejected and everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he's very not happy with that.
Yeah. It's, they are, it's weird because their relationship is very much best friends, but also Steve is kind of his dog.
Yeah.
But they're also kind of like big brother, little brother. It's interesting. We got to play around with that. What was the worst one? What was the one you didn't like the most? I know there's ones that we had difficulties.
Yeah, there was a lot that we had to, I had to redraw things. Sometimes after the inking, sometimes after the coloring.
Yeah, yeah, there was one where we introduced we introduced Satan as a
youth. I loved the used car salesman.
Yeah, he's a used car salesman, bargain belly, as in Beelzebub.
Yeah.
People call him Bub.
Yeah. That one was a long, difficult
process.
Was
hard because it's, you know.
You just like threw them all out there and it's like, yes, this is all wonderful. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
I loved it actually. So
I think that was one that was, I mean, it worked in the end, but it was a difficult concept because it was trying to get, we had two different things going on. We had the conversation between Bargain Belly and Adam in the foreground, and in the background we have Steve
going robo lizard on all the cars.
Yeah, to figure out what a car is, and then sees that the price of one of the cars is RAR. So he's just like, "I found it. This is it. This is the one we got to get right here." But yeah, that one was a little difficult.
I'd have to say though, my least favorite one to actually like work on, not script wise, but like drawing wise, was New Girl when you first meet Eve.
Was it the Eve or the Lilith?
It was Eve.
Okay.
Yeah, when you first meet Eve, I didn't care too much for that one. You know, with the way that I drew it, I could probably go back and draw it again. But
more crotchy.
Yeah, crotchy wasn't in that one. She was sitting cross-legged at a bar, okay. So you couldn't.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, that's the one. And then
maybe that's why I didn't.
She
like
ends up falling in love with Steve.
Yeah,
she's like, oh, he's so adorable.
Yeah, exactly. We had talked about. I think the one. For me, that if I could go back and change it, would be the Christmas one. Just because it's just too long. I didn't have a good handle on editing myself just yet, and I basically tried to fit two jokes in one.
Hmm. Didn't you originally want to do them in two separate ones, but we were running out of time to post them?
Ran out of time, and just let's just put them both together, and we ended up with two. With two jokes that don't really, it's hard to get them to fit together, and it's a little long.
Yeah, visual gag, and then
the visual gag, and then the Yahweh's birthday. They show up with the cake and everything, and
a little early. Actually.
Yeah, a little early. Yeah. Yes. But yeah, that was.
Like,
that was,
sorry, I haven't actually been born and died myself yet.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I think those were our ups and downs for specific strips.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been a really fun process so far.
My favorite was the changing the font.
Yeah, the red letters.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the whole that the Baptists, prefer it in this way.
That stemmed out of when we initially created the character of Yahweh. I was like, first of all, he can't open his mouth. And I specifically said his text, his dialogue needs to appear like it's written on a scroll in old English text.
Very fun to draw.
And I imagine, yeah.
And the letters need to be read. Because I brought that idea from Dogma. You can't actually hear the voice of God because it'll kill you.
I've seen that one.
And she did a great, you did an absolutely fantastic job with it.
It's hard to read.
It's she puts so much detail in.
But that's the way it's supposed to be. So it's perfect.
It's difficult to read. So we got a little bit of feedback from some other fans of the strip on Facebook and whatnot, saying, yeah, it's kind of hard to read his text. I was like, man, it'd be great if we could just change his font. And
new
so
strip
we,
idea.
So we went and changed his font. And my favorite part of that strip is he's trying to get Yahweh. He's like, how do you talk like that? And then the next panel, he says, what? And he actually puts his hand up and
he totally breaks the fourth wall.
Yeah, breaks the panel and says like that. Yeah. And then of course proceeds to change the font. And, that was a really great concept.
And I liked it. It was American English or something?
Yeah.
New American standard.
Yeah. We changed it to that.
The jokes just abound there. If you know all the different types of religion, you're hitting on all cylinders. You're doing a fantastic job there.
Growing up in that very heavy religious background, it was just shoved in our faces all day long. And, so it's great fodder for comedy.
indeed. Yeah. So we ought to move along. We've talked at length here. What are your plans going forward?
Well, we're actually stopping the strip for right now. I know. Oh, no. It's so sad. I'm so sorry.
I'm sorry, listeners. I'm sorry. You've heard it here first, I suppose.
Just for now. I mean, if we have more ideas later, we'll go back to it maybe. But at the moment, I'm working on my bachelor's at UCF, so I'm a little bogged down with classes.
Oh, just a bit?
Just a little bit. Going for game design, actually. So
yeah, just a bit.
Lots of programming classes and things I need to keep up on. Yeah. So even this...
You can't finish...
You can't finish, under construction forever.
Yeah.
Many acronyms. Mm-hmm.
No, it's been under construction forever. They're getting rid of a whole parking lot, and I don't know why. Parking's already terrible enough.
Oh, no. Oh,
it's always been terrible. I went there as well. Yeah, and I didn't finish. So.
It's, you know, we talked about when we first started doing the strip, the handshake agreement was just kind of, I'll keep writing them if you want to keep drawing them. Said if you get, and I would ask you occasionally, do you want to keep going? And she said, yeah, absolutely. And then I said, if I run out of ideas, we'll call it quits. And it happened that I ran out of ideas.
Oh, I still had one. It was going to be a little different.
Yeah, that's right.
We wanted to introduce Steve's parents.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
I drew them out and everything. They were adorable.
Yeah, we drew it out and...
kind of. Had so much else going on with the other strips that we weren't able to fit it in.
Yeah, I had trouble crafting a joke around it. It was a great visual, but we couldn't really get the joke to fit in there.
You've got them now. What are you going to do with them?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And okay. So I said let's do it until we run out of ideas. And my publisher, D. Michael Watkins with Highburn Studios, he, after our third or fourth strip.
I think it was, yeah, about.
Because I've been with that studio for about 2 or 3 years. And he called me up on the phone because we were just posting them on Facebook. We just did it for fun, posted it on Facebook. And my publisher gave me a call and he goes, hey, so I've seen this Adam and Steve strip you're doing. I said, yeah, just doing it for fun, having fun with it. He goes, so would you like to be published with the company you work with? I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot.
Wow, that's like my day job and stuff, isn't it?
Yeah. He goes, okay, well, congratulations. I was like, okay. So I showed up at the college and, went to her office. Yeah, yep. I showed up with the contract and was just like, so... we're published. She's like,
just, what?
Okay.
Yep. All very sudden. I was like, are you sure?
Yeah. So that was a really great way to go. And the best thing Mike said to me was, do whatever you want, as long as it's on time.
So we had free creative right. Write on everything.
Yeah. Do whatever you want, as long as it's on time. Said, okie dokie. And that's what we did. And it seemed to work out. So. But we got to a point where we ran out of, gosh.
See, you should have taken that water out.
I know. I'm so sorry about that.
Jeez, Davis.
We got to a point where we had kind of petered out on the ideas, and we had a couple ones in the can, and we're like, well, you know what? Let's save those, and let's collect the volume, put those strips in there as, never before scene exclusives, which the very first strip, Blueprints, is one of the exclusives, because once we had the character, we went back. It was like, wouldn't it be cool if we did a prequel of Yahweh designing.
Yeah, I was looking through there, and it's like, what, Tim? What's this guy?
Yeah, exactly. And which was really great for what she did, because she actually did mini blueprints and
actually,
digitally.
They were. The blueprints for Adam and Steve are regular 8.5 by 11. The actual paper is about that big. So the strips, they're all separate little panels, like actually cut out and everything.
Yeah, tell them a little bit more about your process, because
it's
not typically, from what I know of
it's
comics,
your process. Yeah, it's so great. What is your process?
Well, when he hands me the script for the new strips, I try to panel it out. In like a small sketch on just regular paper, get it approved by Davis, make sure everything's lined up the way it should be. Make sure it looks okay. Cause he's, my editor. but after that, I cut out the actual individual panels out of Bristol board and I sketch them out with pencil, have another run through with Davis. Then I ink them, get another approval, and then I color them. And at that point, I go back over the pen because when I use the color pencils, it kind of washes the black off a little bit. Like it gets a little dusty. So I end up inking it like twice. It takes a long time, but it was worth it in the end. I mean, I would, we did them every 2 weeks, and in between all my classes and stuff and working at the college, you know, it took me a good week to.
So this is all completely hand drawn, pencil, paper, all that.
Multiple times,
And then
just by me.
And then you scan them in.
Yeah, I had the scanner at home, and then I had to edit a few things. And at the time, actually, for basically the entire process up until the last couple of them that we did just for the bonus, all I had was paint. So it was.
Oh my God! Really?
It was the worst. Yeah. No, it was the worst thing ever.
But to look at the book, you'd never know.
No, no, you wouldn't.
She did such a fantastic job putting those together by hand, which I always emphasize to people. She did that by hand. And she would go, and the most she would do was maybe touch up just a little bit, or if, you know, if there was a little smear or something,
like
she'd get rid of that.
For the letters, the red letters?
Yeah.
Oh, that thing, I hated it. It smeared everywhere. Yeah. And of course, I dragged my hand across the paper like a left-handed person. But I'm not. You know, it's just right along.
But it's, you know, it ended up being really nice because since Mike Watkins, my boss at Hybern Studios, gave me the directive of do whatever you want, we weren't holding to even a certain dimension for the strip. So some of them, like this one, some of them are in landscape.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some of them are in portrait. Some of them are really long and narrow. Some of them are, you know, really wide and narrow. We did a couple of them. We had one, and it's in the book. In the very back, there's one panel where you see Steve jump over a river and run through forest, and then get to a certain spot, and he runs through a couple different landscapes. Yeah, down here at the bottom.
Yeah, and those were all separate panels. I had to put them together. Because I didn't have paper long enough for it.
All the way at the bottom, Andy.
Wait.
A little bit more. There it is, right there. Yeah, he jumps over a river, runs through the woods, and then gets to a spot where he starts digging a hole. We were able to do stuff like that just because of the way she cuts up the different panels. We could literally move them around on a table and say, okay, we like this format. It seems to work. And yeah, just we were able to do whatever we wanted.
I've really enjoyed looking at this, and you two are fantastic to talk to.
Oh, thank you.
I appreciate it.
This has been really a great interview. What are you sketching over there? You just can't help yourself, can you?
No.
Well,
I've been drawing all night, actually.
Yes, we've been today has been putting together the incentives for our Kickstarter, so we're getting everything packaged up.
Oh, wait. You're doing a Kickstarter?
Oh,
it's already happened. Oh,
yeah, we did
darn.
A Kickstarter for the book.
Couldn't get you in earlier. Okay,
I know. Well, shucks. But we did a Kickstarter.
Next time.
Yeah, we did a Kickstarter for the book, and today's been putting together all the packages and making sure everybody's got everything they paid for, and you know.
So much fun.
Boxing it. Yeah, a lot of fun.
But it was successful.
It was.
Yeah, that's the best part.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, we set a goal. We set a goal of $1,000.
Okay.
And we raised a little over $1,300.
Yep.
And so that was great.
Ordered the books.
Yeah, and we were able to get the books from Comics Wellspring. If you got a comic and you're looking to get it printed, Comics Wellspring's good. Probably the best way to go.
Very cool.
Is that one from them?
Yeah, it's from Comics Wellspring.
I will attest, it is very high quality.
Yeah,
it's very high quality paper
and
everything.
Their turnaround time was, they had it to us in 2 weeks.
Yeah, which was great because he's leaving and we had to, you know, get together to sign them. So I was originally planning just to drive up to where he's moving, which is like
600 miles away. Yeah, moving.
I have family
South Carolina
up there though, so
at the end of next week.
Well, next time we'll have you on Skype or
absolutely.
Google Hangout or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent. Okay. Panels, do you have any questions, comments for our guests? I've monopolized the conversation.
Yeah.
again, now that the comic's coming to close, we've heard that student of degree in game design. What is in the future for both of you?
Well, she's doing the game design like she mentioned, and I'm moving back to South Carolina. In addition to working on comics for Highburn Studios, we've got a couple things in the works there. I've done pitches for NBC. I sent a pitch into Mark Millar for a thing he was doing online. I guess it was late last year. I do a little stand up when I can. Unfortunately, my day job gets in the way of that because I work 3 p.m. to 11 p.m.
Oh, and all that's not much of a day job.
Yeah, my quote unquote day job.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, I'm not able to make most of the open mics. But where we're moving to, Greenville, South Carolina has a comedy club. They have the Comedy Zone, downtown. Doug Benson just performed there not too long ago. They have a pretty good string of, pretty reputable comedians that come through there. I'm also looking at, getting on with, a local newspaper, seeing about doing some sports writing for them. I've in the last year and a half, I've really, come to appreciate, sports writing, as the telling. If comics are our modern mythology, mm-hmm. Athletes are our gladiators. So, you know, I'm into football and I played a little in high school. A bunch of my buddies went on to play in college. And, actually one of our coaches when I was, my senior year, was a retired, NFL player. So I have some connections there and, like to where Greenville is at, there's a bunch of different colleges around there. So I'd like to try my hand at that. And I've got a couple screenplays in mind and we're just going to see what happens next.
Screenplays too. Oh, geez.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh man. You're getting all into it. Okay.
Yeah. Every way that I can possibly not make money. That's what I'm trying to, that's the field I'm looking at.
The arts, the arts. Oh,
gotta love the careers in the arts.
Absolutely.
Well, so if you were only in Europe where you could actually get subsidized.
Yeah. There you go. Yep.
We have multiple requests from the chat room. They want to see what you're sketching.
Oh, actually I'm drawing something for you guys. Yes. Just,
oh.
I just, can you we know, see? I'm oh, here, let really me. Happy to that you guys wow. let us on here. So I've never been the on a owl. Podcast before.
The owl is there.
The owl. The are you going to show us what your sketching was from one Jen Gettler? I'm not sure. I'm guessing there's a relation there.
Oh, yeah, that's my mom.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's watching.
Aww. Thank you. Time. Thank you, Mom, for
thank
listening.
You, mom.
Hey, Mom.
We did meet briefly when at Free Comic Book Day. I was just a random guy in line that was recruiting them for the podcast.
Yep.
it's so much fun. Fantastic. I got to give a quick shout out to Rick Shea for having us 2 years in a row at Famous Faces and Funnies for Free Comic Book Day.
Yeah,
he treats us so well. Rick, if you're out there and if you see this, thank you so much for having
us
there.
You.
It was really, really a lot of fun. Yeah, she'll be there tomorrow.
Yep.
Your mom's saying hi.
Hi.
Excellent. Oh, well, our parents should always be our biggest fans.
Of course. I mean, oh, yeah, no, I love them very much.
It was really encouraging to me when, because I would give her the scripts and she would take them home. Mm-hmm. And
my mom loved to read them.
She loved reading the scripts. I was like, well, that's
she always gave me her 2 cents on them too, and I always showed her my sketches and everything. Mm-hmm. Got some feedback too, because my mom, she's got a great artistic eye. She's a photographer.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's great. I have the full support of all my family.
Excellent.
Me not so much.
Well, you know, Davis.
You win some, you lose some.
Yeah, you know.
Why do you have to have all the talent? Why do you have to have it all?
Exactly.
Excellent. Okay. You're welcome to stick it out through the show as long as you possibly can. Okay. But we should probably get on to other things, I think.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, and, do it.
Thank
real
quick,
so much.
And since I've met you know, you, I've listened, we discussed your podcast that you do occasionally, the Hunnic Outcast. I didn't know if you wanted to talk those. And, you know, since we become friends on Facebook, that little project you do on Facebook, if you wanted to mention that as well, you know, your diatribe rants, the car.
So, just really quickly.
Sounds interesting. Okay.
I'm part of another podcast called the Hunnic Outcasts. Basically it's, our host, Jeremy Fain, is a critic. We have,
everybody's a critic.
Of course, everybody's a critic. Edward and Kendra Hale, Edward's, the video game guru and a former comic book artist. Kendra is a very, very accomplished, comic book artist, inker. Mm-hmm. And, she's also doing some writing as well. And then there's me, the writer. So we attack different, comic books, different movies with, you know, all these different perspectives. One episode that we just recorded that should be up in the not too distant future, we reviewed the movie Jungle Book, the most recent, Jungle Book movie.
Oh, I still haven't seen that.
Don't bother.
Tell us what you really think. I heard it was great. I'm going to go see it. I don't care what you say.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine.
I do care. I care.
She's
going to do what she wants.
Yeah. She don't go to school. She kills people.
What?
Are you going to mention your father?
Did he? Oh. Well, I said my family, but he's not talking.
No,
as my mom, I guess. Hi, Daddy.
Hi, Daddy.
There you go. Okay.
Just
trying to keep you on the straight and narrow.
But
my mom saw the Jungle Book. We were supposed to see that together.
Maybe she's thinking the original one.
Well, see, that was my whole thing. Was I had said that if you saw the original or the 1967 animated, then you've seen the new one. There's not a lot different.
Lots more CG, though.
Oh, yeah. Tons more CG.
Lots more CG.
And 100% more Christopher Walken.
That's true.
Which that makes everything better, though.
Here's the thing.
Sorry, Daddy.
Christopher Walken in The Jungle Book would have been really, really great about 15 years ago. Everybody's getting him in their movies now. Because he's Christopher Walken. If you looked at his performance in the live action Peter Pan.
Wouldn't you?
He can't. Well.
I mean, if you could.
Sure. If he's sitting behind a desk just talking. But he can't dance anymore. So the Fat Boy Slim version of Christopher Walken is out.
Yeah.
And he's there. He's there for the cadence of his voice now. And what they did with him in Jungle Book kind of did a disservice to him because he really brought a really great flair to King Louie. Mm-hmm. But then they worked in the original song, which totally broke that. Mm-hmm. So they went in a total different direction. It's like they couldn't decide whether to be original or to be nostalgic. And because they tried to do both.
I heard it was really good. I have not seen it yet, so we probably ought to stop with the spoilers.
Fair enough.
That's probably
as far as I was going to go.
Probably ought to stop with that.
Sorry.
But let's talk about things that haven't been spoiled because they can't be spoiled because they're history. Fred.
Yes.
Hit it.
I got you. I enjoyed changing up history so much last week that I decided to give it a little change this week as well. Instead of targeting a week or a day, I'm really only going to target one thing. And really where that stems from is right now we're kind of looking at the ever-changing culture of our two-party system in politics.
Our two-party system?
Two-party system. Everybody else has had a gaffe. I can't have one.
I'm just pretty sure that you were correct.
Well, there is a two-party system.
I was going to say that's actually very spot on.
Yeah. But you were just correct.
The way that the Republicans are slowly ripping themselves apart and the way that the Democrats seem to be trying to push out someone who wants to bring real change, you know, we kind of see this constant changing evolution in this system. And the story today actually kind of highlights that even more, how on May 20th, 1862, President Lincoln signed the Homestead Act. This is about 150 years ago, and essentially, the Republican Party would be unrecognizable to conservatives today as the current party would be to those in Reagan's time. So, the Republican president, Abraham Lincoln, used the secession of the southern states to push the Homestead Act through to law. The act itself was designed to help lands west of the Mississippi get into the hands of productive farmers. You know, this act allowed an adult over the age of 21, whether male or female, to claim up to 160 acres of land from public domain and utilize it. In order to make the claim, the homesteader would have to cultivate the land, build a house or a barn to improve the land, and then live on the claim for 5 years, at which time they could purchase the land for $10. Some reports also state that the purchase price was $18, but still, 160 acres of land for $10 or $18.
I'd buy that for a dollar.
Yeah.
No, oh, hang on, hang on.
Yeah, no,
I got to make that
our,
shut up.
Our playoff music.
There we go.
There was actually an alternative to the five-year plan as well. Homesteaders were offered the ability to purchase the land after 6 months at only $1.25 an acre. So still, at that point, you're buying, you know, up to 160 acres of land for a little more than $200.
Yes, please.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, really.
The Civil War actually played a huge part into this. How did the Civil War play into making the Homestead Act a reality? That's a good question I just asked myself.
You know, if you need a shill in the audience, you just give me the questions ahead of time.
I'll get with you next week. Similar bills had been attempted by the Republican Party three separate times, one in 1852, one in 1854, and one in 1859. But each time those bills were struck down due to the interest of slave states too invested in the business of slavery to allow the West to be settled by small farming families, basically that would eventually become states that didn't need slaves and would come into the Union as free states. You know, in 1859, it was Democratic President James Buchanan who vetoed that bill, essentially succumbing to the pressures of Southern slaveholding interests. You know, when the Southern states left the Union, President Lincoln used that opportunity to get the act passed. So as soon as the Southern states left, they passed that act, started getting lands into the hands of people that would, you know, populate the West and eventually bring them into the Union as free states. That little Civil War thing kind of ended that whole argument anyway, but, you know, they did use this opportunity. The first Homestead Act claim was filed by a Civil War veteran and doctor named Daniel Freeman on January 1st, 1863. So it took a couple of years or a couple of months to get the first claim in. And the act was actually officially repealed by Congress in 1976, but there was one last title for 80 acres in Alaska given to Kenneth Deardorff in 1979. So, I mean, it lasted for a while. It did.
Yeah, quite a while.
and it did get land into the hands of people that used that land. A lot of times what they would have is, people weren't able to work the full 5 years or weren't able to make it the full 5 years. And so the government would end up taking that land back, reabsorbing it, and then someone else could put another claim in. So at that point, you're putting the claim in on a property that's already been cultivated and improved. You have to improve again. So now you've got a two barn farm or a two house farm. That's 160 acres and you make it the 5 years and now it's yours for the low, low price of $10 or $18. You know, it was a good way. That's where you see some of those, you know, big farming, you know, families where they came from and how they got that was through the Homestead Act. And again, as you're reading through that, you're hearing things like the Republican Party. They're on the side of good. You know, the Democratic Party, they're on the side of evil.
Well,
you know,
so yeah, this is the time when we get to remind everybody that, you know, they shifted.
Yeah, the constant evolution.
Again, remember, you hear this phrase in history, the solid South. There was just a solid voting block that would vote Democrat, regardless who was on the ticket, just because Lincoln was Republican.
Just voting against him.
Yeah. Just voting against the history of Lincoln. Lincoln.
Oh, just yeah. Just voting based on memory. That's not a good way to be. That's not a good way to be at all.
I have a feeling like some people still do that. Especially
they do.
Especially here in Florida.
Too many people.
My parents. to a degree. I got to be a little fair. Okay. Hey, Daniel, do you think you could do our logical fallacy this week?
I will give it a go.
Give it a go. Are you a goer? You a goer? Hey,
let's see here. Let's get our logical fallacy all lined up.
I just dropped that on you, but I figured, you know what? You haven't talked enough.
All right. Well, we have arguing from ignorance. Arguments from ignorance infer that a proposition is true from the fact that it is not known to be false. Now, all arguments of this form are fallacious. If it is known that if the proposition were not true, then it would have been disproven. Then a valid argument from ignorance may be constructed. In our cases, though, arguments from ignorance are fallacious. Example. no one has been able to disprove the existence of God. Therefore, God exists. This argument is fallacious because the non-existence of God is perfectly consistent with no one having been able to prove God's non-existence.
They still need editors. I swear, they still need editors.
But it's a pretty simple concept.
Yeah.
You know, you hear the reverse of this argument more often.
You just can't prove a negative.
Just because you can't see it doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Right.
Well, just because you can't see it doesn't mean it does exist either.
That's right.
There's no proof in either direction.
Yeah.
You know, there's of course, growing up in Christian background as I did, there's a gentleman by the name of Ken Ham.
Oh yeah,
we're familiar.
We
know Ken.
Yeah.
How dare you say that dirty word on our show?
Well, here's the thing. If we're talking about
an R rating, folks.
If we're talking about arguing from a place of intelligence rather than ignorance, it would be good to hear both sides of that argument and see both sides of what I, and I always think back to, you know, the famous debate between him and Bill Nye.
Mm-hmm.
It would be better to view both of their research. I won't say findings. I won't say facts or anything, but to view both of their research and then come at it from a place of not ignorance, but maybe a better place of understanding.
Objective and informed.
Exactly. Yeah. And I've dealt with this a little bit, having worked in law enforcement. Of course, the Facebook police love to jump on pretty much anything that's in the news and denounce a lot of different things.
Sure.
I made the mistake of when things went bad in Ferguson, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people jumped to a lot of different conclusions.
It's our favorite game.
Of course. So I got on Twitter, mistake number one.
Yep. Between that and reading the comments on YouTube.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sports section, listen to her bad words. Don't press send.
Yeah, exactly. So I got on Twitter and said something, what I considered to be very tame, something along the lines of, shouldn't we wait till all the facts are in before we start passing judgment?
Oh, that's far too reasonable.
Oh my God, you would have thought
far too reasonable for
right.
Twitter.
You would have thought that I just claimed to be the Antichrist, and I was just, how dare you say you ought to tell that to his family because they. All right, you know what? Delete the tweet. I'm just forget I said anything, and. The internet
never forgets.
Yeah. And then to see it in mainstream media because, you know, at the college, our department is mostly retired law enforcement. And we've all been through the same defensive tactics and weapons training that's all done by the same man, Bruce Siddle. And we were like, okay, so we're all sitting back looking at the watching CNN or Fox or MSNBC, whatever, going, okay, any minute now, they're going to have an interview with Bruce Siddle. And he's going to talk about how law enforcement officers are trained and what the officer did, what he didn't do, what he should have done, whatever. And we waited and we waited and we waited. And never once did we see an interview with Bruce Siddle. However, we did see an interview with one of the cast members of Grey's Anatomy.
Really?
Talking about what was happening in Ferguson, Missouri. Live from Los Angeles, we have an idiot who knows nothing about law enforcement. Tell us your thoughts, and we'll just digest it like it's so many good nuggets
of
deliciousness. Yes. And he just went on to, you know, crucify law enforcement for everything. And this was all before all the facts were in.
Yeah.
And rather than talking to experts, rather than talking to people who know, we'll just get some, we'll get a pretty boy. We'll get, you know, we'll get somebody who has mainstream credibility, and they can just spout off whatever, and we'll report it as news.
There was a tremendous lack of facts being perpetrated
Ferguson. That's also part of the problem with what is considered the 24/7 news, which isn't 24/7 news, it's 24/7 speculation.
Yeah.
Until there is actual news, and then it's 24/7. That's not the story we're talking about now. Let's move to the next story that we can speculate on.
Yeah. So if it bleeds, it leads.
Right. It's kind of a culture.
Sex, if it's sex, it's on next.
That's always been true, and it will probably continue to be true, unfortunately. Yeah.
Hard journalism died circa 1993.
Yeah.
Somewhere in there.
Yeah, that's fair.
Hard to say. All right. Let's roll along.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
If you're scientifically literate, the world looks very different to you. It's not just a lot of mysterious things happening. There's a lot we understand out there. And that understanding empowers you.
If you base medicine on science, you cure people. If you base the design of planes on science, they fly. If you base the design of rockets on science, they reach the moon. It works, bitches.
And just as we're getting into that, we're going to say goodbye to our guests because they have to get on to whatever they're doing next,
which is perfectly fine. So I can go to Free Comic Book Day tomorrow.
Oh, hey, it's Free Comic Book Day tomorrow.
The continuation.
And I'm going back to work. So.
Oh, terribly sorry.
Right. That's why I'm leaving.
Yeah.
I understand. Okay.
There.
Thank you so much for coming by and visiting us here in studio.
Thanks so much.
Absolutely. And
bye, everyone.
Thank you so much for the sketch.
Bye, everybody.
It's amazing. Oh, my God. Got to show this to everybody again. See you. Oh, this is so getting framed.
All sketch while she wasn't talking on the show. So amazing.
Awesome.
Oh, prize possession.
I'm on Skype, so.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you guys need an extra talking head.
Absolutely. Oh, thank you so much.
I'll,
yeah. Okay. Mike.
Yes.
Wake up.
Tell us about
science.
Wake up. Time for science.
It is time for science.
It is a good day for science.
I always approve of science time. Now, we're going to start off, actually. When I went to edit this today, Andy, I've discovered that you were reading my brain and you need to stop. You need to stop.
I don't know that I can do that.
Mind taking.
Because you put in an interesting little article about Google opening a new...
Would that be Parsy McParse face?
I couldn't. I tried to say it with a straight face. I couldn't manage it. Parsy McParse face. And one of the things that came across my dash earlier this week was Google having a recent huge press release about how they were going to be pushing artificial intelligence in the future. Specifically, we're talking the artificial intelligence of computers managing human languages, which is what Parsy McParseface is about. I did read the article ahead of time this time, because as the article states, the great and terrible thing about human language is its ambiguity. You can have 20, 30 words grouped together, and depending on grammar and syntax and meaning, it can be arranged in so many different ways as to be nearly impossible for a computer to understand. We do this because the human brain is amazing, but a computer has trouble dealing with this and dealing with human language and understanding what we are saying. And this causes problems for text-to-speech and all sorts of other things. And well, they've got new algorithms out that are becoming more and more accurate. Not by any stretch of the imagination is it a magic bullet, but it's definitely a huge step in the right direction for getting computers that can actually talk to us and that can understand us when we talk. So, you know, the Star Trek vision of just being able to address your computer in the open air and it do what you want, that is a possibility thanks to this technology. And this is a thing that, Walt Mossberg was talking about in their press release of, we're pushing artificial intelligence. We want computers that are not just smart, because we know from Deep Blue and all those experiments that we can make computers that are smarter than us in certain applications. They've been beating us in chess for years, and they are working on unlocking the secret of Go, which has been the next big obstacle. Yeah. But interfacing with humans is difficult because we think differently. Because all a computer thinks in is basically math. It's ones and zeros.
While we're a learning machine.
The human mind's
a learning machine.
Yeah, while we think, we don't think –
we're all about abstraction.
Yeah, we don't think in direct derivative logic. We are capable of abstraction and inference. Mm-hmm. Deductive reasoning is something that we can do, but it is not all we can do. Whereas with a computer, it's basically all it can do, and they're working on changing that.
No, it reminds me of a theater exercise way back in the day, history showing, that there are three phrases that are in theater that are the most compelling. And I can be said a million ways each and all have a different meaning. I want you. I need you. I love you.
Yeah.
Just think,
a lot you can do with those.
Yeah, just
punctuation, emphasis, timbre, all of that. Yeah.
And changing all the meanings, and a computer can't figure that out. Well, that's what they're trying to change.
Yeah.
They're trying to teach it more than trying to make computers smarter. They're just trying to teach computers to think like humans do, which is fascinating.
Again, trying to teach a thing that's based on math to learn.
Yes. Not just to learn, but to learn outside of the strict bounds of deductive logic.
Drawing inference from things and hidden meaning, and literally to kind of read between the lines of what we say.
Yeah.
They're teaching it snark. Yay!
So that's new and exciting, and that is what and that is what Google wants to move on towards the future, because they're a very forward-thinking organization. You know, they've got their mobile phones, and they're working on possibly putting out processor chips to compete with Intel and all sorts of things like that. But those are things of the present, and they want to look forward, which is very smart, especially for a technology corporation. Because we see any industry that can't think forward starts to die, kind of like newspapers and cable providers.
Right.
Coal.
Yeah, and Google's investments in D-Wave quantum computing is, they're definitely forward-thinking. Absolutely. Yeah.
And now let's move on to some successes in medicine. We have gene therapy has officially cured its first disease, colloquially known as the bubble boy disease. Complex immunodeficiency disorder or something like that. It's an immunodeficiency problem in which you basically can't develop defenses against diseases, so you need a very sterile environment. Well, they've been working against the tide of religious fundamentalism to modify living humans' genetic code and make victims of this disease develop an immune system. And it's working, which is amazing.
Yeah, and this has been coming around for a long time.
It just goes to show that, science works, bitches.
That's right.
This
is amazing.
Yeah. Along a similar vein of miraculous things in curing, a macromolecule has been developed that could possibly fight multiple viruses at once. The problem with fighting viruses is that every one of them is different. And how the immune system does it is the immune system targets things that are unique to a particular disease, creates antibodies that tag that disease, and then the white blood cells go and attack. Well, that works all well and good, but it still means the immune system has to fight one thing at a time. And that gets problematic whenever you have any situation in which you are immunocompromised. This is one of the reasons that HIV is so deadly, because HIV attacks the immune system itself. So the immune system, which can only fight one thing at a time anyway, now has less firepower to go around. And there's a lot of complicated things going on with this, which makes fighting disease difficult. Well, the boys over at IBM said, screw it. What do all these pathogens have in common? Well, they've got very particular proteins called glycoproteins all on the surface of their little shells. They're all essentially the same. There are some differences here and there, which is how the human immune system tags it, but we can get around that. we can target just glycoproteins of this whole spectrum at once and have one big fat macrophage that attacks and eats all of them.
Nom, nom, nom.
So
it's throwing a shotgun at the problem.
Yeah. It's
I would say more like a grenade.
Yeah. It's very much an area denial weapon because it will find anything that matches this profile, assuming that it is a hostile pathogen, and eat it. And you know, this will be perfectly safe for humans, because our cell walls don't look like that. So it's not going to hurt us.
That's right. And it is safe for humans.
Yeah. It's probably not going to affect any of the symbiotic flora because, you know, we've got all sorts of little microbes inside us that aren't human cells. They just live with us and they're good for us. But, you know, over time, those have had to evolve an outer shell that looks friendly in order for the immune system not to eat them. So if we're only targeting things that are unfriendly, those guys will be missed too. So this is all very fascinating and very good for a healthy future. It actually, when stories like this come up, even though it's going to be 5, 10, 20 years down the line that this is going to be a thing, I am reminded of there was one of the versions of Civilization back in the day. I cannot remember which one, but there was a secret project for like end game future stuff that was basically an immunity vaccine. They solved disease entirely. It didn't happen. And the little video that went along with this secret project that you could research in the far future was a parent and a child going to a museum. And the child asks, what's penicillin? And the parent says, well, penicillin is something they used to give people when they get sick. The child says, what's sick?
Well, that'd be nice.
To which the parent responds, sick is something you will never have to be. Whew. And it's things like this that will give us that future.
Yeah. Oh.
And from IBM.
Yeah. Of all people. You know,
yeah,
idea people.
I didn't even know that they had a medical research division at all.
Well, IBM, no,
they
IBM
have
does
a lot
produce
of different think tanks within the company, which is why it's still relevant.
They produce around 3,500 patents a year.
I had no idea. Yeah. I had no idea that they had a medical research division. So you know, so this is science at its best. This is science doing beautiful things that work, and this, you know, and good news, people. Because science works. Scientists know what they're talking about, and it's not changing anytime soon.
No.
speaking of other things that that scientists are right about, April smash temperature records, putting 2016 on track for the hottest year on record, and we're not even halfway through it. An enormous study was compiled on whether or not GMO foodstuffs are safe for human consumption, and it is overwhelmingly, yes, positively safe.
You moved on. Okay, sorry.
Onto some possibly better news. We talked about Germany being on top of the renewable energy train.
Oh yeah.
Portugal has done the same thing. They've had a landmark effort. They went for 4 days straight with their entire grid powered on nothing but renewable energy. And this was a country that just like 20 years ago was entirely reliant on fossil fuels.
Fantastic.
So, you know, the story that is being shoved down our throats by big oil that renewable energy is untenable in large scale and you can't make that conversion that quickly, it's a lie.
It's clearly possible if you invest.
And it's clearly can be done because it has been done. It's being proven right now.
When you diversify your renewable energy, it's not a problem. If you're just taking the state of Florida, we could use a lot of the underwater hydro engines, put them off the coast, using wave energy.
Yeah, we could use if we had a combination of solar energy, tidal energy, and wind energy, we'd be fine.
Again, in diverse, it's not one that's the silver bullet. It's using all of the different renewables that's the silver bullet.
Yeah, because it just...
It is the diversification that really allows us to be reliant on something. Because you can't rely on just the wind because the wind doesn't always blow. You can't rely on the sun.
The sun doesn't always shine. Sun, yeah. And, you know, but that's not an issue because all of these things can work together. It's not like power from one source is different from power from another. It's just power.
Yeah. You just have to have that capacity, the smart grid that will take from those disparate sources and put them all to use.
And we already have smart grids because that's how you keep a grid from brownouts.
Yeah. Though, obviously, for those of you that are suffering from brownouts a lot during the stormy seasons, you know that the smart grid could get a lot smarter.
Yeah. Well, it also doesn't help that, especially here in Florida, we have a lot of electrically active storms, and you can overload a grid that way. But that's an entirely different argument, because I also think that our grid is just poorly shielded against electrical interference, because this is the place that I have lived, of all the places that I've lived, that deals with storms the worst. But anyway, moving right along.
Yes.
Fair.
Finally, the reason I bring all this up, and I wanted to keep the segment short because I knew we'd have guests and I knew we'd run all long, so I tried to compress the message here. The reason that we're bringing this all up, and this is a point that we hammer every week, and I'm going to hammer it again because it was a good news week for it. Educate yourselves, not just on science, but history as well. You know, there's so much absolute garbage out there about whether or not we can trust science. Our culture is forgetting that the same people that tell you that global warming is fake and vaccines are evil and all that crap, they have a vested interest in you buying what they're selling because they're literally selling you a product. The people who don't want you to buy buy into global warming are the ones who want to keep charging you ridiculous amounts of money for your fossil fuels. That's it. That's all it is.
Follow the money.
And it boggles my mind because on the one hand, we have people protesting the evils of Walmart and McDonald's and other huge heartless corporations. And on the other hand, they're obviously bought and paid for shills are convincing you that global warming is a hoax. And this is ridiculous. And I want to bring up someone to drive this point home. Any of you who have watched Cosmos are going to be familiar with a man named Claire Cameron Patterson. Claire Cameron Patterson was a scientist who – he was doing research into the age of the Earth and looking specifically at lead concentrations and comparing it to meteorites so that we could gauge an accurate age of the Earth. And he was the one who pinned it out, four and a half billion years old, somewhere around there, which was the oldest and most accurate estimate we had at the time. I don't know if that estimate has changed, but it was a benchmark that stood for a long while.
I think it's like 4.6 billion now. It was a little bit
older. It shifted
not long ago.
But it's still, even if it's 4.6 billion, that's still really close to its mark.
Yeah.
He got the closest for his
close enough for government work, as they say.
The man worked at it for something like 6 years and finally was able to pin down a number. And during his study, he started running into anomalies of lead levels in the environment. It was this guy who told us something that we all know is true today. We all take it for granted. We all know this. We've been told it since we were kids, and we don't even think twice about it, that lead is poisonous. Lead is toxic in any amount, and we don't want it in our paint. We don't want it in our toys. We don't want it in our water. All this stuff, we know this. And any time that, you know, some news story hits about something being lead-lined from China, making it over to the U.S., we all lose our minds.
Yeah.
But in his day, the people who made ridiculous amounts of money on putting lead in paint and lead in gasoline spent millions of dollars trying to crush this good science that was telling us we're poisoning ourselves. And it took him from the beginning of his campaign in 1965, it took him 20 years to win this fight. And nowadays, we all take it for granted that lead is bad.
Yeah.
And this is the exact same thing that is happening. Then, as now, people whose profit margins were at stake were threatened by science, paid massive amounts of money to confuse the issue. Then, just as now, those people are still wrong. They're scientifically wrong, and it's verifiable. They're ethically and morally wrong because they're poisoning and killing people for the sake of money. They are lying to you. Stop believing them. If we all educate ourselves, we won't have to wait 20 years for another science victory this time. We can put a brake on climate change now. We can stop poisoning the environment with fossil fuels now. We can feed millions with genetically modified foods now. The rich old men fighting progress don't care about the harm they're doing to our planet's future and to our species. They'll be dead by then. Us, who are alive now, my generation and younger, and our children and our children's children, they're the ones who have to put up with the crap left behind. They're the ones who have to live in that future. So make it a good one and side with science.
There's a comic that always gets my attention every time I see it. And it's the, you know, there's the big climate science denier thing, and you know, somebody's at the board, you know, indicating, you know, the temperature rise and all that, and somebody raised their hand, like, what if we make the world a better place and we're wrong? And it's like, wait, back that, roll that back. You've made the world a better place. Period. That's you don't have to go. Yeah. And we wasted all this money. Making the world a better place. What?
You bring up a good point, because actually when I was writing my segment this week, I did think about when I was writing the bit about, you know, we don't have to wait 20 years for a science victory, and I was thinking about climate change as being one of our major talking points in the show. I don't know if that's quite how I want to phrase this, because Carl Sagan was talking about climate change when he was doing his thing in the 70s. But I thought, no.
In the 80s, yeah.
Yeah, but then I thought, no, because back then it was much less clear than it is now. You know, he was on just the cutting edge of new science that was telling us, hey, this is a trend that we haven't picked up on yet. And you know, our understanding of climate has changed a lot since then, and the prevailing and for a while there, the prevailing scientific consensus was flip-flopped. We aren't causing climate change.
Right. Yeah.
And it, that lasted like a year or so before new methods came out and new studies were released and said, well, no, turns out we were wrong. We really are.
Well, and, yeah, it went in with a biased thought process we can't, we're small. The world's huge. How could we possibly affect the entire climate?
That was the idea for a while there in the scientific community. It was there's no way that we mere puny humans can affect the entire environment, but then they looked at it more closely and they found out that we absolutely are. And I was watching Cosmos, and they were talking about, and Neil deGrasse Tyson was talking about core samples from Arctic glaciers and how you can look at the levels of carbon dioxide trapped in that water ice, because that's all it is. It's water ice. Yeah. You can look at the carbon dioxide trapped in there, and you can see for several thousands of years into the past. And it wasn't until the Industrial Revolution that carbon dioxide levels started to spike heavily.
Yeah.
You can't argue with that. It's there. It's there, locked in the ice.
Yeah, so, it is a historical measurement. We have that evidence.
While our understanding has changed over the years, we have reached a point on this particular topic, climate change, where there can be no more doubt. There is simply too much evidence to ignore. And so the possibility that we are wrong is next to zero. But again, as Andy said, even if we are wrong, even if we're not causing climate change,
but we clean up the environment
anyway. But we clean up the environment anyway. We're still being carbon neutral.
It's still a good thing.
Reducing the amount of poison in the atmosphere. Reducing the die-off of flora and fauna. Where's the downside? The only downside is in the pockets, is the pocketbooks of the people who want to sell you poison.
Yeah, the only downside is that some people lose money on the prospect.
That's it.
But there's always somebody to make money on it, too. There's always somebody that's going to make money on the prospect as well.
We can't deny this any longer. People are actually starting to die over this. People are losing their lives and their homes.
Yes. There are islands that are now underwater.
They're gone.
There are populations in the world that have had to move
There are entire small nations that are going to disappear.
Yeah. Entire populations that have to go somewhere. We are going to have to face a migrant population that we have not had in hundreds of years.
And you think this war refugee problem is bad?
Yeah. This is an environmental refugee problem.
Again, war displaces
they'll never go
in
home
a
again.
Minor amount. There's no home left to go back to.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, with a war refugee, eventually the war will stop and they can go back home. Mm-hmm. With an environmental refugee, their home is underwater. Yeah. There's nowhere for them to go.
Yeah, there's no home. I mean, there's people that say, I can't leave. You know, this is my home. Okay. I'm sorry. Your home left
you're
you.
You're gonna drown.
Your home left
well,
you. You
know? Have fun trying to quick evolve and have gills.
Yeah.
It's like you've been watching Waterworld again, haven't you? Exactly. So,
no. Just no.
Yeah, just no. No, we really shouldn't do that. Okay. Well, gentlemen, I think that's going to wrap it up for the first half of this wonderful show that we've got going on here for show 110. And I encourage all of you that are listening at home that have not been participating in the live stream to, well, you're going to have to wait till Wednesday because that's when I'm going to put it out. But if you're here watching now, then in about 10-15 minutes, you'll get to see the rest of the show. So thank you very much for those of you that have watched and stuck us out with us on Twitch watching the live stream and thanking our wonderful guests. And I got art.
Yes.
We got art.
It's so cute. the little owl.
This is so wonderful. I'm so happy. Okay. And I'll be posting that on our Facebook page and on the show page and everything because I have to. It's moral imperative. So that'll definitely be there. And, well, we'll see you in about 10 minutes, at least if you're in the live stream. Otherwise, we'll see you
Wednesday.
We'll see you Wednesday.